They are elected by you, I am elected by you. I'm constrained as they are constrained by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federalist Society's Article 1 initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federalist Society.
On September 22, 2022, the Federalist Society's practice groups and Article 1 initiative hosted a virtual event titled Two Sides of January 6 was an insurrection prohibiting the election of participants. The following is the audio from that event. Please enjoy.
Hello and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Jack Derwin and I'm Associate Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Today we're excited to host a panel discussion titled Who Decides If January 6 was an insurrection prohibiting the election of participants? Joining us today is a great panel of legal experts who bring a range of views to the topic. In the interest of time, we'll keep intros brief at the outset here. You can view our speakers' full bios at fedsoc.org. Our moderator today, Devin Watkins, is an attorney at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Devin previously worked at the Cato Institute as a legal associate, and his op-eds have appeared in National Review Online, The Hill, Time, and The Federalist, among other outlets. After discussion between our panelists, we'll go to audience Q&A as time allows. So please enter any questions you'd like to ask our speakers in the Q&A function at the bottom right of your Zoom window. Finally, I'll note that as always, all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers joining us today. With that, Devin, the virtual floor is yours.
Thank you. We have three very experienced attorneys with us today to help discuss the disqualification clause, or also called the insurrection clause, that generally prohibits someone from holding federal or state office if they have sworn an oath to defend the Constitution and then commit insurrection or rebellion or give aid and comfort to the enemies of the United States. We're going to discuss a variety of aspects of this clause, what it means to be an insurrection, who gets to decide who has done this, and all kinds of different aspects to this. Our panelists have a long history, each and every one of them, so I'm not going to go through all of that. I'm just going to be focusing on what their current position is and their experience with the disqualification clause, that shows that they're an expert on this specific clause because it is very rarely litigated. We have first with us James Bopp Jr. He is the founder of Bopp Law Firm. He represented Congressman Crawthorne and Major Taylor Greene against a disqualification challenge to their office. Second, we have Press Mullen. He is a partner at Womble, Bond and Dickinson, and an experienced trial attorney who represented the challengers to Congressman Cawthorn on the disqualification clause grounds. Last, we have Corey as managing partner at Statecraft. He successfully represented Congressman Andy Biggs before the Arizona Supreme Court on a disqualification clause challenge. So with that, I'm going to start with James Bopp Jr. To lead us off and help give us a little bit more detail about this clause and what is going on.
Thank you. And thank you very much for letting me participate in this event. Of course, I represented two different congressmen, Cawthorn and Green, in their separate challenges to their candidacy for reelection. Congressman Cawthorn was, of course, subject to a voter challenge through a state procedure, and this is available in every state. However, we brought a federal lawsuit that enjoined the state from pursuing the disqualification challenge because of the Amnesty Act of 1872. Had removed the political disabilities associated with that as applied to him. He then lost the primary, but we kept that challenge off his back. And then the Fourth Circuit, in a moot case, decided it anyway and disagreed with the district court on the Amnesty Act. Regarding Marjorie Taylor Greene, it was kind of the flip side. Same state challenge to her candidacy at being disqualified. We brought a federal case, which our preliminary injunction was denied. As a result, we went through the state procedure, had a hearing, The voters tried to put on a case. The administrative law judge found no evidence, zero, zero, zero evidence that she engaged in an insurrection. So we won the case in state in the hearing, and then in the subsequent appeal in state court. And we are now awaiting 11th Circuit decision on our constitutional challenges to this whole process, including applying Section 3. You know, this is a national effort that has been brought by a group called Free Speech for People. They have brought this against dozens of U.S. senators, congressmen, state reps, local public officials, the vast majority of which had absolutely nothing to do with the attack upon the Capitol, but seemed to be particular targets of liberal distaste. They have already filed letters with every Secretary of State claiming that Trump is an insurrectionist as a result of January 6th and should be denied candidacy in every state. So this is something that will need several wooden stakes in the heart, probably, in order to stop this misguided effort and probably several years of litigation and chaos. This is a classic example of liberal exaggeration, where they weaponize an issue to attack their opponents and democracy. They take something which, in my opinion, was bad enough, which was a despicable attack on the U.S. Capitol, and they turn it into a lie. And the lie is that there was an insurrection on that day. They deploy this lie then to undermine democracy by trying to remove people from office, preventing them from being candidates for office, thereby stripping the voters of their right to elect their representative people and empowering bureaucrats, lawyers, and judges with the power to select who's going to be in public office. Now, the problem that Congress and the American people dealt with Section 3 of the 14th Amendment was that after the Civil War, the Southerners were still electing Confederate leaders to public office, including Congress. And the Republicans in the Congress objected to this and ultimately led to Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. It provides in relevant part that no person shall be a senator or representative, and then et cetera, hold any office, civil or military, et cetera, under the United States or under any state who, having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress or officer or et cetera, to support the Constitution of the United States, shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same. In other words, they cannot take office. If you've sworn an oath, you engage in insurrection or rebellion, you cannot take a subsequent oath in order to take office. The last sentence, importantly, is that Congress may, by a vote of two-thirds of each house, remove such disability. Now, this has several key aspects to it, one of the most important of which, of course, is that it has both retroactive and prospective effect. So the way it is wording, it would affect both what happened in the Civil War. The people who prior to the Civil War had taken an oath, then engaged in insurrection, could not then become, cannot take a subsequent oath. And it had a prospective effect. If this occurred in the future, then it would be applicable. Of course, the most important words are engage and the word insurrection, both of which were very narrow. There was an attorney general opinion in 1867 of those exact words, where engage is an overt, direct act, not mere disloyal sentiments or expressions are not sufficient. And secondly, insurrection is a domestic war, as the Attorney General in 1867 described it. Now, there are several problems with private parties trying to enforce Section 3. First, the disqualification to take office cannot be determined until the actual date when the person on January 3rd presents themselves to take the oath of office. And that is, while someone may have met the conditions for disqualification before, you never know when Congress, exercising its power to remove such disability, whether or not the Congress will remove that disability until the person presents themselves. So you cannot use Article 3 to say, well, you can't run for office, which is what the voters are doing here, because when you show up for to be sworn in, you cannot take the oath because you don't know in the meantime whether or not Congress will remove that disability. So it cannot be used as a weapon against somebody being a candidate for office. Second, there's no private cause of action. I mean, this was decided from the get-go in In re Griffin in 1869. Then Chief Justice Chase, operating as a circuit justice, held that there was no private cause of action for a claim under the Section 3 of the 14th Amendment because only Congress can provide for such private cause of action. This is, of course, continues to be true, as we know, in the Armstrong case recently decided by the Supreme Court. They said that, look, just because something's in the U.S. Constitution doesn't mean you have a private cause of action. Private cause of action has to be specifically provided for. If you as a private party is going to use a provision of Congress against another private party, and then in a footnote they said, well, but of course, if a state uses or a government uses is pursuing you and you have a defense under the Constitution, then you can, of course, always assert that, which is what we are doing on behalf of Green and Cawthorn. And then finally, the Amnesty Act of 1872 removed this perspective. This disability when Congress said that they were removing from a large category of people all the political disabilities imposed by the third section of the 14th Amendment are hereby removed from all persons whatsoever. Well, Cawthorn, Green are all persons whatsoever, and their disability has been removed. Finally, employing Section 3 to prevent a person from being a candidate for office abrogates the Congress's sole authority under Article 1, Section 3 to judge the qualifications of its own members. Because if you remove Green, can't run in the general election, she's not elected, Congress is deprived of the opportunity to judge for themselves whether or not Section 3 disqualifies her, and that is contrary to the Constitution. There's lots of other problems, some of which Corey will talk about, but this is really a terrible, misbegotten effort that could create the most enormous chaos in the history of the United States elections. If we have a candidate for president of the United States, they're challenged in every state on whether or not he or she can be on the ballot. This is the most direct attack on our democracy, on the right to vote, on the ability of the American people to function, to have a representative democracy short of the Civil War. And it's despicable. And while the attack on the Capitol was despicable, this is a despicable response.
Okay. So our next presenter is going to be Press Mullen.
Thanks. And thanks for having me. This is not my normal venue, but I'm here and happy to reengage with my friend, Mr. Bopp, and learn about these things. You know, I think what you heard from Jim was sort of a wholesale condemnation of what's going on here. But I think the problem is this is something that is not a creation of some liberal cabal. This is something that was put into the United States Constitution in 1868. And a determination was made at that time as to who would be appropriate to serve in these various positions. And that determination essentially said that if you fit into this narrow category of persons who had sworn an oath to the United States, then engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the United States, you couldn't come back and hold office. And that was a determination made in the 14th Amendment and is not dissimilar from other determinations that are made in the Constitution regarding the qualifications of candidates, such as that they should be citizens, such as that they should be, if they're going to be members of the House, 25 years and older, with other age restrictions applying to the senators and presidents. So these are not things that arise from a liberal cabal. These are things that arise from the United States Constitution, like it or not. And, you know, if people want to argue that there is bad public policy embodied in Section 3, that in fact, people who do engage in insurrection and rebellion, having previously sworn an oath not to do that, ought to be allowed to continue to serve in office, then that's something that's going to require an amendment to the Constitution. I can promise you, despite the gloom and doom that was painted, and I'm really just a lawyer in North Carolina, this is not my job. Some people came to us who really were not fans of their congressman, Madison Cawthorn, and they were not all liberal Democrats. In fact, when all was said and done, Madison Cawthorn had very few friends among Republicans, Democrats, or unaffiliated voters because of the way that he conducted himself as a member of Congress. But I can absolutely promise you that no letter has been filed with the Secretary of State of North Carolina stating that Mr. Trump is not eligible to run for office. So, you know, sort of looking a little bit more at kind of the historical basis here, and I think this give a broader and I think really more accurate historical picture. And again, you know, my experience is limited to North Carolina with what we did here with respect to Cawthorn, but North Carolina would not be a state in the Union today had it not explicitly agreed to enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And the fact is, the 40th Congress on June 25th, 1868, by a two-thirds majority in each House, and over the objection of then-President Andrew Johnson, passed a law, 15 Stat 73, that was entitled An Act to Admit the States of North Carolina, and there were six others, to representation in Congress. And that act stated that it would take effect upon each of those states, ratification of the proposed 14th Amendment, and it contained the following explicit provision and condition for North Carolina, quote, "No person prohibited from holding office under the United States or under any state by Section 3 of the proposed amendment to the Constitution of the United States, known as Article 14, shall be deemed eligible to any office in either of said states unless relieved from the disability as provided in said amendment." 2 weeks later, 2 weeks after North Carolina was readmitted on that condition, on July 9th, 1868, the 14th Amendment was fully ratified. So the argument that the operation of the terms of Section 3, through state processes, in particular the North Carolina process, somehow thwarts the will of the voters by permitting bureaucrats to strike disqualified candidates from the ballot, that's an ahistorical argument. That is precisely what Section 3 was intended to do. Voters in the former Confederacy, and Jim mentioned this, they wanted to continue to be represented by insurrectionists. North Carolina even tried to send its Confederate governor, Zebulon Vance, to Congress, and he was not allowed to take his seat. And our nation, not our congressional district, not our state, but our nation, adopted an amendment that mandates that this very small slice of humanity, insurrectionists who had previously taken the oath, are disqualified from serving no matter how much the voters of their state or district prefer them. The Constitution doesn't allow the voters to send teenagers or Chileans to Congress, and they can't send insurrectionists who have taken the vote either. And so we've had this process, in North Carolina through a challenge process, and with respect to Cawthorn, and the case was, Mr. Bob contended, was mooted. It actually wasn't mooted in the legal sense of the word, and the determination was made that the Amnesty Act did not apply to Mr. Cawthorn. In the other case where the court ruled against Marjorie Taylor Greene's claim under the Amnesty Act and other provisions, Mr. Bopp went to court. And as he stated, the ALJ, as you would expect a procedure to work, made the determination that she did not fit the category of insurrectionist. And now, as a result of the good work done by Jim, we will now be treated probably for at least the next 2 years to the public policy discussion that Marjorie Taylor Greene brings to Congress. And we won't be deprived of that as a result. So, I will say North Carolina, in addition to that readmission commission condition, very shortly after being readmitted, North Carolina, through its Supreme Court, determined in a case called Worthy that an individual who had held office, in fact, he was just a sheriff of a particular county in North Carolina, but under a Confederate government, was not entitled to continue to hold office by virtue of Section 3. So, again, private parties. That's the way North Carolina set up its challenge procedure. If someone wants to run for Congress, or frankly, any office in North Carolina, it's utterly amazing. I'd encourage you to check out the form that you have to fill out in order to run for Congress in North Carolina. You basically have to put your name and address and sign it. You don't have to aver that you are a citizen, which is obviously a requirement under the Constitution. You do not have to aver that you are a citizen of the state, which is a requirement under the Constitution. And North Carolina has chosen, as one of the 50 states, that the way that it will police this is by allowing the candidates to submit a very sort of sparse form that doesn't require them to say very much or do very much. And then there is a procedure for challenging it. And it is a procedure that involves voters from the particular district, or could be voters from anywhere in the state for a statewide office, to essentially lodge a challenge on a verified complaint. And then the candidate needs to come forward and say, I'm 25 years old. I am, in fact, a citizen of North Carolina. Or in the case of the particular thing we're talking about with respect to Section 3, no, I didn't engage in insurrection. And the fact of the matter is there are 13 congressmen in North Carolina, 7 Republicans, 6 Democrats, and only one of them would have any difficulty in making the minimal amount of proof that I assume none of us on this call would have any difficulty making, that we have not engaged in insurrection. Now, on the Amnesty Act, the issue was the issue was that Mr. Cawthorn asserted that in 1872, that Congress passed a fairly broad amnesty, as is permitted under Section 3 that took, again, a very large swath of Confederates and said, you are no longer covered by this. And in that circumstance, that was something that, covered those particular persons, didn't cover other higher ranking Confederates, but certainly we argued did not cover future insurrectionists, the unborn insurrectionists. Go ahead.
Well, we'll be coming back to you again. I just wanted to give Corey a chance to say his thoughts, and then we'll return to you afterwards to kind of reply to what Corey thinks as well. So with that, Corey, if you can please explain your thoughts on the insurrection clause.
Sure. thanks for having me, Devin and Jack. I've been asked to address two issues, and the first is how we should think about the phrase "engage in insurrection," and this ends up being issues that the phrase is not defined in the Constitution. I guess the meaning of the words is just kind of assumed. And courts have struggled now to define that. Careful definition that we've got from the courts through this series of cases is from the New Mexico court, which actually is one of the more interesting cases this still pushes.
And we're having a little bit of audio problems on my end. Can you make sure your mic is plugged in fully or something like that?
Yeah. Is this any better?
Yeah, it was going in now. Hopefully that fixes it.
All right, great. As I was saying, there's no constitutional definition of engage in insurrection. And the courts have struggled to define this. One of the more interesting definitions we've got so far is from the New Mexico case, which is still pending. New Mexico has banned from office a county office holder there, and that case is still on appeal, but it's been appealed, as I understand it, to the New Mexico Supreme Court. Let's start, before we get to how the New Mexico court defined engage in insurrection, let's start with what almost certainly is not insurrection. And I think that's actions by members of Congress on the floor of Congress or in preparation or furtherance of actions on the floor. So a number of the lawsuits, I think six of them, that have been brought were against congressional candidates, either the House or Senate. And all of those relied to some degree on arguments that the defendants, the congressional candidates, had made on the floor of the House, and in one case, the Senate. And because of the speech and debate immunity clause, I think that it's very difficult, probably impossible, to say that what you do on the floor of the House, basically your official duties as a congressperson, can be used to eventually disqualify you from office, right? So I think when we're thinking about what it is to engage in insurrection, I think we can just rule out official actions of a congressperson. But what's left after that is more difficult. So if we're looking at statutory law, there is 10 USC 253, which is in a section defined, or just called insurrection. But again, there's no definition of insurrection in that statute, right? The meaning is just kind of assumed for the readers to understand. So the definitions then really are drawn from historical practice or just case law. So, and the problem is that there's a spectrum there, right? So what Jim Bopp was saying at the beginning is the Attorney General defined insurrection as something approximating war. That's a very narrow definition. There's not many things we can point to historically as being an insurrection under that definition. But the New Mexico court defined it much more broadly. What they said, based on historical sources, I'd encourage you to read it. It's a thoughtful opinion. He says an insurrection is, one, an assemblage of persons, so you can't do it alone. Two, acting to prevent the execution of one or more federal laws. Three, for a public purpose. And four, through the use of violence, force, or intimidation by numbers. Now, that's good insofar as it goes, but once you start thinking about it, it includes a lot of things, right? So the occupation of downtown Seattle may well count. The burning of post offices in protest of police violence, you know, may well count. And so, you know, where is it? Is this the correct definition for the New Mexico court, or is it something that's equivalent to war, like Jim Bopp was saying? I'm not sure. And I think that's an issue that's still open to argument. Now, the further point, though, is that it's not enough to have been proximate to an insurrection. You have to have engaged in insurrection in order to be disqualified. And so let's assume for purposes of this conversation that January 6th was an insurrection, that, you know, whatever the definition, January 6th was that. You can imagine someone who thought they were going to attend a speech and they were there on Capitol Hill on January 6th, but sort of, you know, blindly walked around unaware that people were transgressing laws. Maybe that would be difficult. It sort of depends on very much on the person's perspective. But it's not enough to be present. You have to engage, says the Constitution. So as Jim Bopp said, the Attorney General's previously said, it can't be words or sentiments, it has to be acts. But I'm not sure that if pressed, the court would agree with that. Like, what if the words you use are urging action by others? Well, that may be sort of aiding and abetting your conspiracy liability in a criminal sense. And so perhaps words are enough if it's inciting an insurrection. That's not been decided yet. And I think the of all the cases that have been brought so far, the only one who's lost, this guy in New Mexico, still on appeal, had the most direct connection to violence of anyone. So the congresspersons were, the allegation of insurrection arose from them acting on the floor of the Congress. That apparently wasn't enough. But the person in New Mexico apparently was urging others to act. He was proximate to people who were calling for violence, it seems. He was transgressing the boundaries that had been set up, apparently disregarding some sort of notifications that the assembly was unlawful, right? So that's much closer to what you could say is engaging in insurrection than all the other defendants in these series of cases. All right, so hopefully that teases out a little bit more, like what it means to engage in insurrection. I think there's still room for argument on that in the cases that remain. The second issue I've been asked to speak to is who decides, you know, where is the proper forum for proving a violation of the insurrection clause? Well, for congressional candidates, I think the answer is pretty clear. The exclusive authority to decide the qualifications of members of Congress is vested in the Congress. And so for, you know, the six congressional cases that have been brought, it seems like those people should have been able to proceed to the ballot. And if they win, have the issue raised and litigated before Congress actually seats them. For the others, though, for all the others, as press points out, for example, the North Carolina state candidates, the argument is this: from the defendants of these cases, they say, this is a federal law. If you're going to have private enforcement of it, Congress must create a private right of action to enforce the federal law. You can't have a state statute creating a private right of action to enforce federal law. And then on the other hand, you have, you know, press and his peers arguing that surely if there is someone who engages in insurrection against the United States, and enforcement of that provision has been a condition of admitting states to the union, there has to be some way of enforcing it. And so in New Mexico, for example, where they disqualified the candidate, the court there did that under their quoeronto statute. Every state has one of these and basically says you can sue to throw out of office, eject from office, someone who lacks the necessary qualifications. And so there is no federal statute creating a private right of action under the insurrection clause. But at least in one case, they have found that the state quoeronto statute is enough to create a private right of action. And that's kind of like the fault line of how that argument breaks down. I will point out that on the defendant's side of this, the idea that there must be a federal private right of action created, there is the Griffin case from 1869, which, as Jim points out, was decided by the then Chief Justice writing circuit. So it's a very unusual lower court case written by the Chief Justice. And he found, for what it was worth, that the you must have a federal private right of action created in order for there to be private enforcement of this. There is a criminal statute. The government can enforce insurrection cases, or you can disqualify people from office based on a criminal prosecution. But so far, no federal right of action created by Congress. Well, Devin, I think I've talked too long, and so I'll yield the floor back to you. Thank you.
So with that, I'm going to return to Pressmullen to respond to Corey on the insurrection clause or disqualification clause.
Yeah, I think Corey makes some very good points, and I do think that this law is going to need to be litigated and determined in these various forums. I'll tell you from my perspective, what happened on January 6th, and from the perspective of my clients who swore out challenges against Cawthorn, it was a violent insurrection for the purpose of trying to prevent the peaceful transfer of power after a legitimately certified election from one administration to the next. And those are not my words. Those are the words of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell from February 8th. 2022. I would also say that on August 5th, 2021, Congress passed Public Law 117-32, which was a law to award the Congressional Gold Medals to the United States, four members of the United States Capitol Police. And in that public law, Congress made the following finding. In section one, on January 6, 2021, a mob of insurrectionists forced its way into the U.S. Capitol building and Congressional Office building and engaged in acts of vandalism, looting, and violently attacked Capitol police officers. So, again, these are, and by the way, Madison Cawthorn voted for that law. To Mr. Bopp and Corey's benefit, I think their clients did not, their other clients did not. Ms. Taylor Green did not. The Arizona Congress people voted against that law. There was a question in the chat box. And by the way, I think Corey's observation about the speech and debate clause is a very pertinent one, and one that goes back to Parliament in England, where they were jailing people for what they said on the floor of the Parliament, certainly through the time of Queen Elizabeth I, but then that was considered to be a very bad practice. What I can tell you about Cawthorn, and this was a question in the chat, is that Cawthorn was sworn into Congress on January 4th, 2021, the youngest member of Congress, probably the most immature member of Congress. 2 days later, and having previously urged in December that his followers lightly threaten their members of Congress, and according to the organizers helping plan some of the day's events, he was one of just a small group, two or three congressmen who spoke that day at the so-called March to Save America rally. And he encouraged the crowd to, quote, go and fight in Washington, D.C., rather than just sit idly by on our hands. He pointed out to the crowd the distance and direction to the Capitol. And within a couple of hours, as we all saw, a massive crowd breached the Capitol in a violent insurrectionary effort to impede Congress from certifying the election in favor of President Biden. And what we saw that day was horrific. And at least from my perspective, everything we've learned since that day is even more horrific. And when the time came to decide in a congressional law what that was, Cawthorn said, yeah, that's an insurrection. So, that's, I think, that point. on the who decides issue, I would just say with respect to Griffin, if anybody is suffering from insomnia, please go read the Griffin case, the circuit decision of then Chief Justice Chase. I think that the Griffin case can very naturally be cabined to the very peculiar circumstances that were present in Virginia at that time. Really doesn't talk about a private right of action. The issue is really whether Section 3 is self-executing. And what Chase said there was Section 3 can only be, is not self-executing. It can only be executed by an act of Congress. But this was at a time when Virginia did not have a state government. It was under military control. And so from that perspective, was much like, say, Washington, D.C. is today. And only something enacted by Congress could ever do that. I think when you look at, you know, what North Carolina was conditioned to do, what North Carolina did, what Corey mentioned, which was President Grant, upon taking office, had the U.S. attorneys throughout the Confederacy prosecute dozens of quo warranto writs against persons who were disabled from doing this. I think that really sort of tells the tale. So North Carolina chooses to vest with voters in a given district the question of making a challenge as to qualifications. This is a qualification, and the North Carolina State Board of Elections found that it was so. And that's the procedure, and that is a procedure that can proceed from the North Carolina Board of Elections through the courts on an expedited basis under the North Carolina statutes.
Okay. Now we're going to be going on to questions. If anyone has any questions, please use the Q&A feature. I'm going to ask a question, and then we will see if we can get to some of the audience questions. So my question is to James and Corey. In the case of the... in the case of Davis, it's saying Chief Justice Chase said that the 14th Amendment, Section 3, it needs no litigation and legislation on the part of Congress to give it effect. From the very date of its ratification by a sufficient number of states, it began to have all the effects that its tenor gives it. If its provisions and punishment, the punishment begins at once. So why is that not the case for the 14th Amendment? Why does it need some type of enacting legislation to come into effect by Congress?
I'll be happy to address that. Of course it had effect because the states are empowered and required to enforce Section 3. And that's perfectly consistent with the Constitution. States are obligated to follow the Constitution. That's a provision of the Constitution, so they're empowered to enforce it. That's not the issue that I was addressing or that Griffin addressed. Griffin addressed, and I was addressing, whether or not a private litigant, i.e. voters, could enforce Section 3 against another private party using the state procedures. And and of course they've sued in Wisconsin. They sued in court to to take out Senator Johnson and other public officials there. So they think that they can enforce it. No, they can't enforce it unless, as under Griffin or any reasonable reading of the 14th Amendment, unless Congress authorizes it pursuant to Section 3. And of course, Congress has never authorized private enforcement of the provision.
I'll add a thought to that. If there is private enforcement, whether through state quo warranto statutes, or if Congress were to create a private right of action, or if it's implicit, let's say, we've got to confront some difficult questions. So you basically have private enforcement at that point of a criminal statute. You have to prove a crime in order to prove the violation, and so it's, I think, a quasi criminal action. That's a fair characterization. And what standard of proof would apply then? I think it should be clear and convincing evidence. I don't think you should be able to prove a quasi-criminal claim through a preponderance standard. But courts haven't really confronted that issue yet, right? What restrictions would apply to plaintiffs, and would they have like Brady restrictions if they're aware of some exonerating evidence? Would they have to disclose that as a constitutional matter, not just as a matter of state procedures? So there are a lot of problems that go along with private enforcement of quasi-criminal matters, which just had not been confronted yet because most of the cases haven't gotten that far.
Okay. The next question comes from the audience. He asks, rather than case-by-case litigation involving dozens of individuals or perhaps dozens of different states all around the country, so maybe some deciding one way or another, how do you see this being resolved in some type of consistent forum? Or do you plan to see it being resolved on 50 separate actions? Well, I'll bring this to Mr. Mullen. Do you think some type of multi-district litigation that kind of consolidates all of these together would work, or some other way to resolve this in a fashion that is consistent among all the different states?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I really don't know the answer to it. You know, I do know that I'm not going to be representing a class of putative insurrectionists who want a declaratory judgment that the statute is unconstitutional in some way. I will say this, and it follows on from your previous question, which I think is broadly sort of addressed to the issue of who decides. It's very typical, and particularly with respect to presidential candidates on the ballot, for these to be considered to be state issues in the first instance. And, you know, there are cases in the 10th Circuit, cases in the 9th Circuit that all deal with these issues. And I think, you know, I think the states should be free to enact in the first instance their own procedures about how a candidate may qualify and what a candidate must satisfy in order to do that. In North Carolina, if you're not an eligible voter, you can't run for office. If you have a pending felony conviction, you would not be an eligible voter. If somebody put their name on the ballot through what, as I described to you, is a very simple North Carolina procedure of filling out a form that would take all of 5 minutes and had been convicted of a felony, I think that's something that a state is entitled to do, to keep a felon off the ballot the same way you would keep a felon from voting.
Okay. The next question from the audience was, how close to the line would engaging in protests where some are violently attempting to interfere with a United States Supreme Court decision-making rather than Congress? I know we have some rowdy protests outside of judges' homes right now. And at least last term, the Supreme Court had to put up some very high fencing to keep out people from the court. And we know, for instance, Schumer came out and said to the justices, you know, you will reap the whirlwind if you do that. And some interpreted that at least as rather hostile views. And perhaps at least one individual attempted to actually assassinate a Supreme Court justice. You know, and some have argued that it was based on some of the speech that Schumer and others had done. Where does it kind of cross the line into insurrection? I assume Schumer is not on the line of insurrectionist, but how much further does it have to go before there's like protests or violent protests or pushing against Supreme Court police to have it can be also considered an insurrection?
There's a lot of First Amendment protections to speech, including what people would call incitement speech. There's been a series of cases in the Supreme Court, one in the NAACP, where there have been very specific threats made by, in this case, an NAACP official, very specific threat. They were going to be victims of a crime, that they were going to come for them if they didn't, you know, observe the boycott or whatever the issue was in the case. And the court said that's protected by the First Amendment. You and I think so that cabins the use of speech, what's protected by the First Amendment, which can be very aggressive in terms of threats that are made. And so that's off limits, all right? As Corey said correctly, with speech and actions on the floor of Congress, that's off limits. And then now we got to deal with the word engage, okay? Engage is not a word of speech, as the Attorney General said in 1869, but direct overt act. Now, a direct overt act can be, for instance, the commander of a brigade of Confederate soldiers telling them to hit, to attack the hill. I mean, that's speech, but it's a direct overt act of launching an attack in conjunction with, obviously, a war in that case. But that's a very narrow category, okay? Because if engage doesn't mean conduct, what in the world would it mean, okay? Now, there can be words that are so connected to conduct that it would be engaged, and I would agree with that. But let me give you the example of Marjorie Taylor Greene, right? Of the 100 exhibits, the hours and hours of testimony, the videos and everything else, it came down to one appearance on one television show before January 6th, where she said, January 6th will be our 1776 moment. Now, that was a phrase that was being used by the members of Congress who were going to object to the electors, okay, and whether or not those votes should count in Congress. And that's what they were being prepared for. What you don't know, and probably no one on this call knows, is that there was this fringe group over here that created a secret 1776 project, which involved a protest at the Capitol at the time of the counting of the votes. So that secret, and they called that, and they're correct, that's a code word, right? In other words, a word that every one of us would associate with the most important year in the history of our country, our independence, with a fringe group's project regarding January 6th and the Capitol. That was the only fact. Now, insurrectionists need to be charged with a crime. By the way, no one who was involved in the attack on January 6th, as despicable as it was and as violent as it was, not a single one has been charged with engaging in an insurrection. The closest you get to that is sedition. Sedition is a much broader term, and it is not engaging in an insurrection. So not even the FBI and the Justice Department that have people who are actually doing things that are unlawful have ever had the gall, the audacity, or to take political hyperbole to that extent of actually charging one with a crime. Marjorie Taylor Greene, on the day of January 6th, was on the floor of the United States Congress doing her constitutional duties when the attack occurred. To her great surprise and terror, they thought, who's attacking the Capitol? Is my life in danger? She's texting her family about her life being in danger because people are attacking the Capitol. So she is charged with engaging in an insurrection. It's not that insurrectionists shouldn't be punished. It is weaponizing a term and a process like this to go after your political enemies. And if it would be Trump, and Presley, the Free Speech for People website says they sent letters to every Secretary of State in the United States saying Trump is not qualified. So okay. I'm just going from that. Can you imagine repeating Cawthorn and Green and the Arizona case throughout 2024 and trying to figure out how we can elect a president if Trump. Okay.
Let's let Mr. Mullen respond to that if he wishes.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, the, you know, people have been charged with sedition. I don't know the details of the New Mexico case that Corey was talking about, but what I understood is that this fella, who is a, you know, county commissioner in New Mexico, who had sworn an oath to defend the Constitution, is, you know, essentially standing on the steps of the Capitol and urging them to, you know, go on, boys, you know, beat the crap out of the Capitol Police. You know, the fact of the matter is, you know, it's all well and good to talk about Antifa, and I doubt many of them took oaths to the United States. It's all well and good to talk about pro-life or pro-abortion demonstrators that y'all do. But the fact of the matter is, what happened on January 6th, you know, there are consequences from that. And, you know, in Jim's case, with respect to Marjorie Taylor Greene, it sounds like the system worked. And she was found not to have engaged in insurrection. And good for her. But to the extent that there were others who were in there bashing in policemen's heads, looking to hang Mike Pence, looking to impede the government, engaging in sedition, which apparently Jim thinks is some sort of low-level crime with respect to the United States, there are consequences. And it wasn't liberal operatives who were doing that, unless, as some of these congresspeople have said, oh, that was really just Antifa demonstrators on January 6th. But I know none of y'all believe that.
Corey, did you want to respond at all?
Yeah, I think the original question was whether, you know, Supreme Court protesters may be crossing a line. And let's just think about the elements of this, at least as the New Mexico court defined it. It's probably the clearest definition we have so far. I'm not sure it's correct, but it's reasonably clear. And one of the elements there is numerosity. You can't have an insurrection alone. You've got to be part of a group. And so I don't think the guy who wanted to assassinate Justice Kavanaugh committed insurrection. He was alone. Mm-hmm. If it's correct that giving orders could constitute insurrection, then, like, you know, I guess you'd have some sort of argument for Senator Schumer, although I don't think you know, any court would find that constitute insurrection. You also mm-hmm. have to be not just disruptive, but trying to impede a governmental function. Right. And so showing up outside the Supreme Court and being like very loud and you know, expressing disapproval isn't enough. You have to stop them from functioning in some way. And so I don't think that those examples are likely to be found by a court to constitute insurrection. So much of what's doing the work here is just an intuitive sense of what does an insurrection look like. And that's about the best authority we have at this point because the legal decisions are sparse.
Okay. One of the questions was, can you review the Fourth Circuit ruling? Was it procedural, or did they find that Cawthorn was an insurrectionist? My understanding was that the Fourth Circuit ruled that the Amnesty Act did not apply prospectively. It applied retroactively, but not prospectively. Fourth Circuit may have been right or wrong on that, but then they remanded back without actually deciding if Cawthorn was an insurrectionist. Now, Cawthorn lost his primary, so it effectively ended that process because it didn't matter anymore. But that's what the Fourth Circuit ruled. Is there anyone else that wants to discuss the Fourth Circuit ruling? No? Okay. Let's see. And the last question currently on the list from anyone in the audience is, why has no one been charged with the insurrection? Have they been charged, and if so, with what? Maybe Mr. Mullen, why has no one been charged with insurrection?
I mean, obviously, that's an issue well beyond anything that I would have anything to do with. I represented a bunch of rank and file voters in North Carolina. I mean, a lot of things have been charged with respect to what happened on January 6th. Some of those include seditious conspiracy. Some of those are obviously continuing to be investigated, and I don't think the charging is necessarily all done. And there are a host of things that have been done. And, you know, one of the things that's interesting to me is I don't know how many of those people who were doing what they did on that day, things that I think all three of us would agree were acts, you know, unquestionably acts. I don't know how many of them would fit the category of persons who would have sworn an oath. You know, very few young people, for example, would have sworn an oath. Very few, you know, high school graduates without, you know, proceeding on to college or law school will have sworn an oath. So I think it's sort of an astonishingly small number of people. I don't think this is going to be some kind of brush fire. I'll be very surprised if that's the case. But I do think that, you know, the nation decided in 1868 that these people were not fit to serve in federal and state office. And I think that that decision continues to today.
Okay. Well, with that, we're at 2 o'clock and we're going to have to end. So I want to thank everyone for coming out today and having an interesting discussion.
Thanks so much, Devin. And I'll echo your thanks for the rest of our panelists as well. And thank you for our audience for tuning into today's event. You can check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all the major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date. With that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article I initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/articlei. That's fedsoc.org/articlei.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.